good evening and welcome. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, a possible turning point. Kevin McCarthy is still short of the votes he needs to become House Speaker, but an emerging deal helps him chip away at the House Republican holdouts.
Hiring slows in December amid a worker shortage that presents significant challenges for employers.
And David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the second anniversary of the Capitol insurrection and the scars left on the nation.
Welcome to the NewsHour. After 4 days and 13 rounds of voting, the House made some progress today, but has still failed to elect a speaker.
While more than a dozen Republicans switched their votes to support Congressman Kevin McCarthy today, a handful of hard right members refused to back down. As Lisa Desjardins reports, McCarthy is hopeful he'll soon be able to convince some of those holdouts to back his bid for speaker.
After 4 days of counting votes,
the House will be in order.
Deal-making on the floor and behind closed doors, there is still no Speaker of the House. But there was some big momentum for Kevin McCarthy. A total of 15 members who previously voted against him changed their votes.
Kevin McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy.
But he still didn't receive enough support to take the gavel. The changed votes came after McCarthy agreed to back some of his opponents' demands that would weaken the power of the speakership.
But for too long, minority rights have been stepped over. Too few people are making too many decisions for the American people in ways that undermine the health and well-being of this institution, the country, and the American people. That has a chance to change today.
McCarthy himself says the battle could be resolved as early as tonight.
I think you saw we made some very good progress. We'll come back tonight, and I believe at that time we'll have the votes to finish this once and for all.
Some Republicans, frustrated by the now handful still blocking him, walked off the floor as Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz railed against McCarthy.
Mr. McCarthy doesn't have the votes today. He will not have the votes tomorrow, and he will not have the votes next week, next month, next year.
That's the question. Will the remaining hardliners keep that up, or will enough of them reverse themselves? Meantime, without a speaker, congressional business has been halted on several fronts. Members are still not sworn in, so some constituent services are left on pause. They also cannot receive national security briefings.
This is obviously a once-in-a-100-year earthquake for the House of Representatives from a political perspective.
Brad Fitch is the president of the nonprofit Congressional Management Foundation. He says the House can't fully function until there's a speaker.
The Congress needs two functioning political parties. America does not have a parliamentary one-party system. The founders gave us a system that requires both parties to be functioning. So a dysfunctional Republican Party isn't just bad for the Republican Party. It's bad for the Democrats, it's bad for America, and it's bad for the Congress.
House Democrats continue to remain a united front, admonishing Republicans for the stalemate.
These 4 days have tested House Republicans' ability to govern, and they have failed.
And the House took a few hours break, but they are coming back late tonight. Jeff?
So what's expected to happen at 10 p.m. Eastern when the House reconvenes, Lisa?
All right, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. on the West Coast. Everybody get your popcorn, because my reporting is that tonight the expectations are the Republicans will select a speaker, and it will be Kevin McCarthy. Not only that, Jeff, but the plan right now, of course, everything can change. It's strange times. The plan right now is to elect the speaker, swear in all the rest of the members of the House, and pass the rules package before they go home for the weekend.
Well, let's talk more about that rules package, because McCarthy started turning the tides in his favor after he agreed to those concessions with his Republican detractors. Tell us more about the ones that would limit the authority of a House Speaker.
Let's take a look at this. This is very interesting stuff, and we'll be talking about it perhaps for the next 2 years. First, at the top of that list, Mr. McCarthy has agreed to allow any single member of the Republican conference to call a motion to vacate, a motion to challenge his own speakership. That is something that's existed before, but in the last few speakerships did not. And in addition to that, he has also agreed to allow more Freedom Caucus members on key committees, like the Rules Committee. Those are the opposition to his speakership, largely came from the Freedom Caucus. Finally, he has agreed to bring more votes to the floor. That's something that I think McCarthy has said in the past, that he wants an open process, more amendments, more chances for House members to put something out there that may win or may lose. But that is a strain on any speakership's power, because essentially one of the speaker's real authorities is to determine what has the muster to pass in the House. Here he is saying, I will let many more ideas reign, but that does diminish the role of the speaker.
And tell us also about these rules changes that would change the way the House handles spending.
You know I'm a spending nerd, so this stuff is really important, but it will matter a great deal to how our government operates and what it does. First, at the top of the list, as I said, Mr. McCarthy has agreed to allow open amendments. Any amendment to spending bill can be on the floor. That means we will have some very long spending debates in the House. The debt ceiling increase, which we know will need to happen sometime this spring, must be accompanied by some kind of budget reforms. There are no firm details on what that means yet. In addition, they are requiring that the House pass spending caps with a budget. Now, it's interesting, that could include caps that could affect defense spending. That's going to be a debate for Republicans. And finally, no omnibus or giant appropriations bills. Jeff, I think what we're going to see here is a very rigorous House floor, but once they try and get together with the Democratic-led Senate on some of these spending ideas in the fall, we're going to have some real issues.
Lisa Desjardins, you and our politics team working around the clock this week. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Today marks 2 years since the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, an anniversary that was marked today in ceremonies in front of the Capitol building itself and at the White House.
Almost exactly 2 years to the moment that rioters breached the U.S. Capitol, President Biden awarded the Presidential Citizens Medal to 14 Americans, all involved in resisting efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election or in physically defending the U.S. Capitol that day.
Our democracy held because we, the people, as the Constitution refers to us, we, the people, did not flinch. We honor a remarkable group of Americans who embodied the best before, during, and after January the 6th.
The medal is the second highest civilian award given to those who, quote, performed exemplary deeds of service for their country or their fellow citizens. The parents of late Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick accepted his medal. He suffered multiple strokes after the riot, one of five police officers to die in the days and months after January 6th. Capitol Police Officer Eugene Goodman was also honored. He single-handedly lured rioters away from the entrance to the Senate chamber as lawmakers were evacuating. D.C. Metropolitan Police Officer Daniel Hodges suffered injuries after rioters pinned him against a revolving door and beat him with his own baton, leaving him maskless and bleeding. The president recognized election officials and poll workers who rejected lies that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. Former Arizona Speaker of the House, Rusty Bowers, resisted efforts from fellow Republicans to overturn the election results. He lost his seat in the state House last August to a Republican challenger. Ruby Freeman and her daughter, Shay Moss, both worked as election workers in Fulton County, Georgia. They described an emotional testimony to the January 6th committee how they faced a barrage of harassment and threats after former President Donald Trump targeted them with false accusations of fraud.
This turned my life upside down. I don't want to go anywhere. I second guess everything that I do. It's affecting my life in a major way, in every way, all because of lies. For me doing my job, same thing I've been doing forever.
Thank you all very much.
The White House calling the honorees heroes and defenders of democracy, who demonstrated courage in a national moment of peril. Earlier in the day, congressional Democrats held a moment of silence on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. The event, led by former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and new Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries.
We are gathered here to honor their memory and acknowledge with deep gratitude the tremendous bravery of the hundreds of officers who defended us at this citadel of democracy that fateful day.
The moment of silence lasting 140 seconds, 1 second for each officer injured during the attack.
In the day's other headlines, the last jobs report for 2022 shows the U.S. economy cooled somewhat in December. The Labor Department says the economy added a net 223,000 jobs, still healthy, but the lowest in 2 years. The unemployment rate fell to 3.5%, the lowest in 53 years, and average hourly pay rose 4.6% from a year earlier, but that was the slowest pace in 16 months. Wall Street took heart from the latest jobs report. Major stock indices shot up 2 to 2.5% on hopes that, with inflation cooling, the Federal Reserve will throttle back on interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 700 points to close at 33,630. The Nasdaq rose 264 points. The S&P 500 added 87. Buffalo Bills player Damar Hamlin is breathing on his own and able to talk after doctors removed his breathing tube. It marks the latest progress in Hamlin's recovery, 4 days after his heart stopped during a game. At a virtual news conference, Bills coach Sean McDermott said teammates spoke to Hamlin today for the first time in a video conference.
He made the heart symbol probably more than anything. And then he gave him a thumbs up. So, and then somewhere in the midst of that, and it was a little bit hard to hear, but he, as you'd imagine, he said, I love you, boys. And of course, I think I got the guys.
Hamlin is still listed in critical condition at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. Asylum seekers from Cuba, Nicaragua, and Haiti ran into new restrictions today along the U.S. southern border. The Biden administration's policy change sends them back to Mexico if they cross illegally. Some crossings in Arizona were quieter than usual overnight. Some people who arrived at the border said they were stunned to hear of the new rules. Mexican authorities are working to restore order in the northern city of Culiacan after drug cartel gunmen turned it into a war zone. The violence erupted Thursday when federal police captured the son of Joaquin Guzman, the imprisoned head of the Sinaloa cartel. Gunmen burned vehicles to set up roadblocks, battled government troops, and fired on planes at the international airport. At least 29 people were killed. Northern California caught a break in the weather today as the second powerful storm this week subsided. Piers and oceanfront homes were hit by hurricane-force winds, heavy rain, and monster waves on Wednesday and Thursday. Flooded roads left people in Santa Cruz wading in water and wondering about recovery.
You know, don't have a huge lot of resources for something like that. It's going to take weeks easily, if not months, because there's a house down at the end of the private neighborhood that completely lifted off its foundation and is sitting in the middle of the street, blocking the rest of the neighborhood off.
The storm was blamed for at least 2 deaths and major power outages. To make matters worse, this week's third storm is expected to roll in tonight. In Ukraine, a Russian-declared truce for the Orthodox Christmas holiday took effect despite air raid sirens and sporadic fighting. In Kyiv, people ventured into the streets to run errands for Christmas Eve celebrations. But officials and citizens alike voiced deep skepticism about the truce. Meanwhile, the United States unveiled a $3 billion package of military aid for Ukraine, the largest yet. It includes armored vehicles, self-propelled guns, and artillery rounds. The Supreme Court of Idaho has ruled that the state constitution does not implicitly endorse the right to an abortion. The court rejected efforts by Planned Parenthood to block enforcement of a series of new laws. They include a statute that criminalizes most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. And the Environmental Protection Agency is proposing tougher standards on soot from tailpipes, smokestacks, and wildfires. The agency said today that lowering the allowed levels could prevent thousands of premature deaths each year. Some environmental groups said the proposal does not go far enough. Still to come on the NewsHour, a journalist and critic of the Indian government faces spurious charges designed to silence her. Where prosecutions of the Trump supporters who attacked the Capitol stand 2 years later. A new project spotlights the work of indigenous American artists, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today's jobs report signaled good news for those who are worried about a recession and inflation. It also capped a very strong year for the jobs market overall. More than 4.5 million new jobs created in 2022. That's the second highest year ever since record keeping began back in 1939. But it still suggests that it's hard to find enough workers for some jobs. Economics correspondent Paul Salmon has this report.
The final jobs report of 2022 hints that this year's economy may be okay after all.
There is nothing to complain about in the December jobs report.
ZipRecruiter jobs maven Julia Pollack says on top of 223,000 new jobs and a rock-bottom unemployment rate of 3.5%, the report highlights a key metric that will make the Fed happy, though not workers.
It showed wage growth moderating, which is exactly what the Federal Reserve wants to see, and which reduces the risk of a recession.
Because it reduces the danger of continued inflation.
Yes, because it reduces the risk of continued inflation and of the Fed needing to throw too much cold water on the labor market.
In the context of the COVID years, Pollack says 2022 turns out to have been just right.
The December report suggests that 2022 was a Goldilocks year in the labor market.
A Goldilocks year.
Yes, well, 2020 was much too cold with millions of jobs lost. 2021 was too hot. We added 6.7 million jobs and the result was surging inflation. This year, we saw 4.5 million jobs added, so still an enormous number, but not so large that it caused inflation. In fact, inflation moderated and wage growth moderated.
But even with an employment report this strong, the labor market remains spandex tight. Why, I asked Pollack earlier in the week.
Well, before the pandemic already, there was a downward trend in labor force participation that was mostly driven by the fact that we have a rapidly aging population.
True in Canada and Europe as well, with myriad job openings. But Pollack cites causes peculiar to America.
One is a decline in participation among working-age men that one doesn't see in other countries. And then also, labor force participation among women, prime-age, working-age women, is rather sort of sluggish and flat, even though it's growing pretty rapidly in other developed countries.
What's the explanation?
The rates of crime and incarceration, which are barriers to employment. Another is the increase in the use of drugs like opioids and fentanyl, which are also keeping people out of work.
And the plateauing of women? Not happening in Europe or Canada.
Mostly because other countries have family-friendly policies like paid family leave, and the U.S. does not.
I've been hearing two other reasons. The slowdown in working-age immigrants, and for years now, from employers all over this land, that young people just aren't interested in so many of the jobs out there. Trade jobs, face-to-face, the military. As Karen Paolucci, head of HR at industrial robot maker Yushin in Rhode Island, told me.
You can schedule someone for an interview and they don't even come for their interview.
And I've heard a harsher charge from numerous employers in recent years. Today's young Americans just don't have the work ethic of the past. The response we got?
I have work ethic for the things that I want to work on, that I feel will better myself and be good for my health as well.
Would Jennifer Reardon in Lawrence, Kansas, who calls herself not a housewife but an apartment wife, take a frontline job?
I would do that. If I knew that my labor would be valued, that my personhood would be valued, that I wouldn't just be another cog in this machine that keeps endlessly grinding us downwards.
College-degreed 22-year-old Fable, who goes by first name only. What was the stress like working at Starbucks?
Unbearable. just constant or nonstop. I think that's a good way to put it. If we were paid enough to actually survive, then yes, this sounds, then I could probably handle at least some of the stress some of the times.
Fable says the options are go back to school.
Or I go to one of what we quote unquote call unskilled jobs, and then I don't even have enough to afford living outside of my parents' home, which I'm doing anyway without working, so might as well just do that.
Just two data points, what I call anecdata, but is it some evidence of the entitlement charge?
If you go and sit in the archives, you can find newspaper articles and radio segments dating back hundreds of years where people make the same argument about the young.
Bottom line today, it may still be hard to find good help, But if your main worry was recession in 2023, layoffs, bear market, today's jobs report is being viewed as something of a storybook ending for 2022. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solomon.
Indian journalist and Washington Post contributor Rana Ayoob, one of the main critics of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist government, has long been a target of trumped-up investigations, hate speech, and online harassment. She recently won the highest award for press freedom from the National Press Club in Washington, but is now headed back to India to face trial for sham charges of money laundering. She says it's the latest attempt of the government to silence her and is emblematic of what journalists in India face. She joins us from Dubai now. Rana, you welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks for joining us. You're returning home to India to face these charges. A court has summoned you. That's why you're returning. And in summary, I guess we can say they allege that you've mishandled money that you raised for victims of COVID-19. I know the legal case is ongoing, but what can you tell us about these charges?
Well, Amna, it's not the first time that allegations against me have been leveled by the government of India. They have leveled money laundering charges against me. They have leveled tax evasion charges against me. They have accused me of misusing funds, which they have not been able to prove. And I'm not the only one. Money laundering has become like the latest tool for the Indian government, the latest charge that the Indian government has been leveling against all journalists, critics, and activists in India. Indian journalist Sadiq Kappan has been behind bars for the last 2 years for a story he did not report. And just when he was about to be freed by the courts, the Enforcement Directorate filed money laundering charges against him. The conviction rate of this charge against people is less than 1%, and that speaks volumes of what this case means.
We should note the Committee to Protect Journalists, other journalism groups, even a United Nations body has called this judicial harassment when it comes to the cases and charges against you. Specific to your charges, I'm wondering, why do you believe that the government has set its sights on you?
I have been critical of the government. I have written cover stories on the Modi government and his rule since 2014, the fact that he has not taken a single press conference in the last 8 years. I've been calling out his Hindu nationalism, the attack on the 220 million Muslim minorities. In the World Press Freedom Index rating, India has gone from 142 to 158th position. And I'm not the only one. I'm still like, I consider myself a privileged one because I'm able to speak to you and you know, point out the illegalities in my case. Journalists in Kashmir are being arrested under Public Safety Act for their journalism. They're not even allowed to leave the country to collect their awards, even for that matter, their Pulitzer awards. So that's where we are. The journalists in this country have become the enemies of the state right now.
We should note, too, you've had your bank account frozen previously. You've been prevented from traveling previously as well. You mentioned you're not the only one, though. This is not just about what the government and government officials have lodged against you. There's been an online campaign as well. You faced threats there. Tell me about that. How bad is that?
Well, Amna, sometimes I feel like deleting my Twitter account. I've actually started self-censoring myself because, you know, the moment I tweet even a word, the kind of replies that I get are nauseating. My image has been mobbed on a porn video and circulated all over the country. My phone number has been circulated on social media. My address has been put out there. Burnt copies of my book have been sent to my residence. One of India's leading journalists, Gauri Lankesh, was shot dead in 2017 because she was allegedly by Hindu nationalists. Till today, we don't know who killed her. And I do remember that 2 days before she was shot dead, I remember she called me and she was telling me about the online hate against me, saying, "Babe, these are all paper tigers. They don't attack." And yet 2 days later, she was shot dead. So there is, I mean, whether it's online, whether it's offline, I feel like it's relentless. And the only target is to basically silence us into submission and silence us from speaking the truth.
Rana, you are scheduled to go back to India. What are you worried will happen when you do return?
I don't know. I feel like a lot of people said, don't go to India. There are so many sham charges against you. I believe this is my truth, and I'm heading back to India because that's my country, and those are the stories that I want to report and I will report. The people who are doing this do not want me to return to India and do not want me to do the stories that I do. But it is my moral obligation and moral responsibility that I continue doing this and talking about what's happening in India to the rest of the world, so which is why I'm going. What happens is, again, I have I'm completely out of depth at this point of time. So I will leave that to probably the judiciary and see what happens from here. But I can say this, that my truth will not stop. My journalism will not stop. My quest for justice will not stop.
That is Indian journalist Rana Ayub joining us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Amna.
Two years on from the deadly January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, Justice Department officials continue to work to hold those responsible to account. Congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins is back with a report on where those prosecutions stand.
USA! USA! An attack on the U.S. Capitol, now simply known by the date it happened, January 6th. Exactly 2 years ago today, thousands of supporters of President Donald Trump, encouraged by his words,
"We fight like hell, and if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore."
The Capitol building
violently disrupted the counting of electoral votes for the first time in our nation's history.
Judy, there are protesters. Protesters have now broken into the U.S. Capitol.
It would take 6 hours for law enforcement to secure the building and grounds, and another nine for Congress to finish certifying the 2020 election results. An estimated 250 officers were injured that day, and a 2021 bipartisan Senate report found that at least seven people, including three police officers, lost their lives in connection with the attack. Since that report came out, two more officers who served on January 6th have died by suicide. At least 15 people were arrested in the Capitol on January 6th. Most rioters simply returned home, kickstarting the largest investigation in FBI history.
It's really an enormous, enormous undertaking.
Mary McCord heads Georgetown University's Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection and is a former Justice Department official. More than 950 people have been charged with crimes related to January 6th.
The scope of the charges coming out of the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th is very broad. We have everything from misdemeanors such as trespassing on federal property all the way up to felony offenses that carry a maximum penalty of 20 years imprisonment.
Derek Evans served 3 months behind bars.
I don't really know how I feel about everything right now, to be honest with you. I really don't.
This was him that day. Live streaming on the Capitol steps, he entered the Capitol with the crowd. For that, Evans pleaded guilty to felony civil disorder, a charge he sees as grossly harsh because he committed no violence. He shows how the ideas, tensions, and resentments of January 6th remain. Evans still defends the people who were there.
I think it was a group of patriotic Americans who were frustrated with what's been, you know, happening in this country.
But do you understand that as being part of that mob, that was a threat to democracy?
Well, first of all, I still wasn't a part of a mob. I was part of a group of patriotic Americans who were exercising their natural God-given rights to free speech.
Some might say you sound unrepentant. Is that right?
No, that would not be accurate. I'm not going to regret my actions on that day. I do regret that, I was part of a crowd that has now been, labeled as people who were violent, even though I didn't do those things.
Not everyone was violent, but the crowd overall was very violent. According to the FBI, so far, nearly 200 people have been arrested for assaulting police officers. That is more than one in five of all charged. Rioters have been arrested in 48 states.
Proud Boys.
According to a recent study, about a third of them have connections to extremist organizations. That includes two leaders of the far-right Oath Keepers. Stuart Rhodes and Kelly Meggs were found guilty of seditious conspiracy in November. It was the first conviction on that charge in almost three decades.
So seditious conspiracy is a charge that's fairly rarely brought in the U.S., but here it really does fit what happened. It is a conspiracy to violently hinder or delay the execution of U.S. law.
More than 500 people have been convicted of various crimes. The vast majority of them pleaded guilty. The FBI is still seeking tips from the public about hundreds of other people involved in January 6th, including the person who planted two pipe bombs near the Republican and Democratic National Committee's headquarters the night before the riot. Meanwhile, hovering over it all have been questions and charges related to former President Trump's involvement.
On this vote, the ayes...
1 week after January 6th, the House of Representatives voted to impeach the then president, charging him with incitement of insurrection. A month later...
It's laid upon the table.
The Senate will come to order.
Mr. Trump's team defended him in the U.S. Senate.
President Trump did not incite the horrific, terrible riots of January 6th.
Where a majority found him guilty, a figure short of the required two-thirds. He was acquitted.
President Trump summoned the mob, assembled the mob, and lit the flame of this attack.
That summer, a House Select Committee launched what would become an 18-month investigation into January 6th, focused on former President Trump. After interviewing more than 1,000 witnesses, the committee aired testimony in 10 public hearings from those close to Trump.
The president said something to the effect of, "I'm the effing president, take me up to the Capitol now."
And those who bore the brunt of the violence.
Never in my wildest dreams did I think that as a police officer, as a law enforcement officer, I would find myself in the middle of a battle.
Last month, as it finished its work, the committee referred Mr. Trump to the Department of Justice on four criminal charges, including aiding or comforting those involved in an insurrection. For his part, Trump and his allies have stressed these words of his to the crowd on January 6th.
I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard.
He has decried accusations against him and insisted he is a political victim.
Why aren't they investigating November 3rd, a rigged and stolen election?
To this day, the former president continues to lie about his 2020 election loss. He has repeatedly praised rioters and condemned their prosecution.
What they've done to torment people and go after people like never before. I don't think anything like this has ever happened in our country.
2 years on, despite the mayhem and bloodshed, the danger of January 6th lingers. It is a powerful political device for some on the right. Remember Derek Evans? He's now running for Congress and says the actions that got him prison time help with many voters.
Honestly, the biggest response I get from the people of Southern West Virginia when it comes to January 6th is thank you. Thank you for having enough courage to go do what so many people wanted to do.
Administration.
In November, Trump kicked off another presidential campaign for 2024. Days later, Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed a special counsel to continue investigations into the former president's actions in the aftermath of the 2020 election.
I have concluded that it is in the public interest to appoint a special counsel.
Earlier this week, as trials and investigations into the January 6th attack on the Capitol continue, the People's House once again opened its doors to visitors. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins in Washington.
On this anniversary of January 6th, correspondents Laura Barrón-López and Nick Schifrin also took a look at the domestic and international consequences of that day.
How has January 6th changed the way the United States is perceived around the world?
Well, there's no question that January 6th was a shock to the system. The biggest headwind to our work in trying to support those who are seeking democracy for themselves and having a more democratic world is what happens in the United States.
We can look at the fact that our system worked. It was for sure a propaganda gift to authoritarian adversaries. What those countries can aspire to do is to weaken us internally, to cause us to further divide ourselves, including through misinformation and propaganda and influence operations.
Are you concerned about voter suppression, gerrymandering when it comes to where the U.S. democracy stands?
I am very worried about the state of our politics. I'm very worried about what's happening in Congress. I'm worried about the state of the Republican Party. But I am more optimistic about the ability of Americans to sustain this, you know, diverse, maddening, complicated democracy we call our own.
You can find both Nick's and Laura's interviews at pbs.org/newshour.
At the end of this chaotic but also reflective week on Capitol Hill with the House Speaker's battle and the January 6th anniversary, we turn to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Good to see you both.
Great to see you,
Abna.
So it took 4 days, over a dozen rounds of votes for Kevin McCarthy to just break the logjam to try to work towards getting the votes to become speaker. He hasn't done it yet as we sit here and speak right now. But David, let's talk about the holdouts, the ones who have consistently, the small number of members who consistently oppose him and still do. Are they just anti-McCarthy? Are they never going to back him?
I don't think they're anti-McCarthy. I think there are two schools. There's Chip Roy, who we saw earlier in the program, a congressman with a goatee. He does want to change the rules. And there's a case to be made that Congress needs reform. Most of them are not like that. And in my view, it's wrong to call them very conservative. There are a lot of Republicans who are very conservative. These are nihilists. They came here, and they're quite open about that, especially with their friends. And they say, we just want to burn the place down. And we normally think that those of us who go in, even into journalism or go into political life for sure, that you have some positive agenda, like you want to do something good for the country. That is absent in these people. It's a posture of rejection, a posture of negativity. And so they just want to be negative, be oppositional, and then go on TV and say everyone else is screwed up. And so this is a form of nihilism that is in the Republican Party. It's certainly in the conservative media sphere. Tucker Carlson was very much on these guys' side. And it's something really that's a menace to the health of that party.
You agree with that assessment?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is nothing to add, really, to what David said. I mean, the fact that there's going to be another vote maybe tonight McCarthy breaks the logjam and gets the 218 that he needs. But nihilists don't care about the schedule. They don't care about the timetable. They don't care that folks won't get paychecks because there's officially no Congress. They want to blow stuff up. And what better way to blow stuff up than to, with each vote, destroy the dreams, hopes, and aspirations of Kevin McCarthy.
So whether it's McCarthy or someone else, can anyone govern this caucus?
At this point, no. With the rules package that they just released moments ago, whoever the next speaker is going to be beholden to the Freedom Caucus, beholden to these nihilists.
If you have a number of these Freedom Caucus members on the Rules Committee, right? If you have Kevin McCarthy, we understand, reportedly has already allowed them to lower the threshold. It's going to be really easy to get rid of the speaker if they want to. What does that mean for the next 2 years?
Yeah, well, the Rules Committee is the one that really strikes me. That's the committee that schedules, that controls the floor. And so it's just going to be a lot easier if you get those that many people in the Rules Committee for them to just block things. And so it could be nothing will happen in this Congress just because they have the ability to block. But the thing, and I think Jonathan mentioned this last week, that absolutely has to happen is we have to raise the debt ceiling sometime around July. And if we do that, the full faith and credit, if you don't do it, the full faith and credit of the United States is destroyed. So they're going to want to attach all sorts of riders to that, that the Democrats will not accept a balanced budget amendment, things like that. And that means it's highly unlikely. I don't see how they get a debt ceiling raised in the summer with this political landscape, and that would be catastrophic.
I mean, that's a remarkable thing to say.
Yeah, we've had the fight. I think in 2011 there was a fight about it, but sanity prevailed. And we are the last best hope of Earth, but we're no longer sure sanity's going to prevail. So that's what we're staring at.
Dare I even ask, how do you think this ends? Just this round of the battle for the speakership?
Oh, look, hope springs eternal. I think McCarthy will eke it out. But what will it mean? Really, he'll be speaker in name only, living under threat of being removed every moment of his life, the moment he gets the gavel. And to your point, my biggest fear is the debt ceiling. The only thing we can hope is that Kevin McCarthy would have enough guts and fortitude to go to Leader Jeffries and say, I need 212 of your people to vote for raising the debt limit, and I will bring six, and we can take care of this. But if he does that, he's done.
Do you see that happening?
No, but I think the main threat for any normal mainstream conservative Republican is the threat is the 20 on the right. The threat is not a bunch of moderate Democrats.
Right.
And so if I was McCarthy, and this would be a political ender in this world, I would just go to 40 Democrats and say, what do you want? Let's do that. And it seems unrealistic, but there are a bunch of states right now that are doing that, where they have an independent speaker, where they've had leaders in the state legislatures who are not of the ruling party, or they've cut deals, bipartisan deals. So it's plausible in a universe other than our own.
I mean, there's a bipartisan model we can point to this week, right? When you see it was pretty dramatic split screen to see President Biden and Mitch McConnell standing before what they call a legislative miracle, right? That bipartisan infrastructure bill that's going to yield a bridge project in Kentucky. That's a really dramatic contrast we saw.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the line, the threshold that needs to be drawn. You can like Mitch McConnell, not like Mitch McConnell, like Joe Biden, not Mitch. They're professionals, and they have a sense of basic honesty and decency. You might not like George Bush, you might not like Barack Obama. They were admirable human beings. We're not seeing that, but the threshold, we've sunk below that threshold among a lot of people in Congress.
Meanwhile, we should note, as we did earlier, different kind of chaos, right? On Capitol Hill 2 years ago, we marked the anniversary of the January 6th insurrection today. I'm curious, the further away you get from that day, how you view it now.
I still view it with trepidation. Just think about it. 2 years ago today, we saw thousands of people instigated by the then president of the United States who stormed the Capitol trying to overturn a free and fair election. Exactly 2 years later, we're still seeing chaos in the House of Representatives when the party of that president, a lot of whom voted not to certify the 2020 election, new folks who came in running on the big lie, going after Kevin McCarthy and not voting for him and rendering the place into chaos as part of, to my mind, the ongoing insurrection. What happened on January 6, 2021 is still happening. And I think, you know, to set up a contrast, this split screen moment that we're in this country, at opposite ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. At one end, you've got the President of the United States working with the Senate Minority Leader, Republican, on bipartisan infrastructure, whatever, showing what governance can look like when opposing parties come together for the good of the country. And at the other end, of Pennsylvania Avenue in the Capitol, they can't 14 ballots so far and still don't have a speaker. It's just an ongoing insurrection, and I don't see when the party gets out of it, the Republican Party gets out of it, or we as a nation get out of it.
David, among Republicans, that election lie that drove Trump supporters to the insurrection that day, that's still very potent. Right?
Yeah, I think they're sort of moving on beyond Trump, but they still say it was a lie. And so there's a lack of loyalty to the truth. And when I look on after 2 years, and now we have a longer time frame, so I think about the gradual, all the doors the Republican Party and the country had to walk through to get to January 6th. And to me, you know, I don't want to prettify the past. There was Father Coughlin, there was nativists. There's been a lot of ugliness in American history. But I would say over the course of my lifetime, and frankly my, at one time, alliance with the Republican Party, there were a lot of doors they walked to that created what you might call a loss of moral knowledge. That it was the panic of Rush Limbaugh, a lot of what happened to the Christian nationalists and the evangelical communities. There was on the radio, on TV, the rise of Tucker. And so the standards of acceptable behavior went down and down and down, and the tolerance for violence went up and up and up. Mm-hmm. I read in Jonathan's fine section, the Washington Post editorial today, the number of threats to members of Congress has gone up tenfold since Donald Trump was elected. 10,000 death threats to members of Congress. So that's just in the air. And that's not attached to one person. It's a virulent stream of ideas. And ideas have consequences, and bad ideas have January 6th.
And I would add that in all the examples they use, Tucker and Rush and everyone, what we had not seen up until Donald Trump was a sitting president of the United States. Well, first, a candidate for president of the United States who stirred that pot, and then who continued to stir that pot of our nation's, you know, subterranean demons, bringing them out in the open, and then doing it from the Oval Office. And that has a power that I think we're still reckoning with. The idea that a leader of this country, someone who's supposed to lead all of us, was using that platform, that bully pulpit, to actually bully people, specific people in this country. And that's why we've seen, I think, threats against members of Congress or elected officials go through the roof. Because if the President of the United States can do it, why can't I?
It's been a remarkable, remarkable 2 years. So much has happened. But as you know, it took a long, long time to get here. It will take years to unravel and fix a lot of this. Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, thank you so much.
Thanks, Amna.
Thanks, Amna.
Once overlooked, but no more, art by Indigenous American artists is getting more attention these days, and one new project has found a way to push the movement further ahead. Jeffrey Brown has our report, the first in a series on contemporary Native arts for our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
On a hilltop in New York's Hudson Valley, buildings housing artworks created by contemporary Indigenous artists from the U.S. and Canada. Among them, Never Forget, by Tlingit Unanga artist Nicholas Galanin. Beauty the Beast, by Santa Clara Pueblo artist Rose Simpson. War Horse in Babylon, by Jean Quick-to-See Smith, of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Nation. Curator Candace Hopkins.
I say it's a bit of an activist collection because it's meant to correct, you know, this absence, particularly for these major institutions.
An activist collection?
Yes, which means that it has a single purpose. You know, its purpose is to support the work of living artists making work right now.
Some of the activism is making sure it gets out in the world.
Absolutely. And we try to reduce as many barriers to that as possible.
Hopkins, a citizen of Carcrosh Tagish First Nation in the Canadian Yukon Territory, is now executive director of Forge Project, co-founded in 2021 by philanthropist Becky Gotchman and art dealer Zach Foyer, with a clear mission: to support Native artists through purchases of their work and then to lend those works to museums and other arts institutions, raising awareness of and access to Native art. It's part of what Hopkins sees as a growing movement.
People are recognizing that one of the missing narratives in American art history is actually the narrative of the development of Native art and the influence Native art has had even on how we understand this country, how we understand the formation of this country.
The buildings that house Forge were originally designed by famed Chinese artist Ai Weiwei. The location, the land itself, is important.
Forge is about establishing presence, right? It's about Indigenous placemaking. And that's just not about people.
It's not just about the art.
And it's not just about the art. It's of the places where we live.
This is an area known to the famed 19th century Hudson River School of Art. Landscapes that captured the drama and beauty, but not the original inhabitants who'd been killed or displaced farther west.
To return to this region, I think for Native folks is also, you know, to talk about what that original desire was, but to say, you know, there's actually longer histories of these lands. They've been populated for an incredibly long period of time.
But Forge's main target is the art world. Its collection now has some 144 works by 48 artists, and it has loaned art to institutions far and wide, including the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles, the Tucson Museum of Art, the Whitney in New York. For Hopkins, 45, it represents a shift from when she was first starting out.
There were so many good Native artists working contemporary art, but they still weren't getting the big shows. It was a kind of, you know, the beginnings of a kind of national conversation that had been, you know, coming actually since the 60s. But what they needed was they needed allies in these large institutions.
Bias? Racism? I mean, what, hostility? What is it? What do you think?
I think that there was definite bias, and I think that, you know, most of the people that were in positions of power had no knowledge of this work, and they didn't take the time to get to know it. That shows that there's a kind of elitism that underpins a lot of institutions, and it, you know, it kept a lot of us out.
Forge also offers residencies to Native artists of all kinds. One is Laura Ortman, a White Mountain Apache who's long lived and worked in New York. A musician and composer, her sonic genre bending has been heard and seen in performing arts venues and museum exhibitions. Forge and other new initiatives, she says, are making a difference.
We could find each other through these pathways artistically, which I was missing for many decades. Something's happened where that loneliness and isolation is disappearing. And why is that? Because we're making spaces for ourselves. We're taking care of our own communities and making sure it's not silenced anymore. You know, it's incredible. I love that.
Also expanding the scope, subject matter, and styles that define Indigenous art today. Some contemporary artists are using older materials such as beads, long considered the stuff of craft, in new ways. Others find new paths to explore long simmering issues of land use and displacement.
One of the definitions of Native art is that, you know, we don't have boundaries between our, I would say, our personal lives, our political lives, and our artistic lives, because they're all intertwined. You know, we don't have that privilege.
Exhibitions of Native artists at leading museums in recent years offer signs of change. Forge aims to build on that momentum.
You need to have support from institutions and collectors. There needs to be critical writing about that work, so catalogs and essays, exhibitions. There needs to be an art market, so that work being represented by galleries.
In theory, if you're successful, then you wouldn't be needed anymore.
That's right.
You'd go out of business.
Right, exactly. And that would be success.
That day remains far off. For now, the collecting and lending continue. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at Forge Project in New York's Hudson Valley.
You know, it's striking to see how the richness, the significance of the art extends to the land itself.
That's right. And I loved how the executive director talked about how projects like this actually help Native artists create their own space, not just change the institution.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, be sure to join us here later tonight on PBS as Yamiche Alcindor joins her panel for Washington Week. And tune into PBS News Weekend for the latest on the battle for the House Speaker.
And we will be back here next week with Navy veteran Mark Frerich's first TV interview since being released by the Taliban after 2.5 years held hostage.
You know, the 3 years, I never broke down and cried, never, I came close, but I wasn't going to let them. They may have stole nearly 3 years of my life, but I wasn't going to let him steal my soul and spirit.
That interview right here on Monday. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us. Have a great weekend.